convince me, John, that we don't need a park. We shouldn't have something here.
September 67.
I mean, from the, balancing the necessity for such a law and the evil, or assuming that there is an evil there is in place that needs to be corrected against the potential, or the potential problems that such a statute might create, I'm kind of persuaded that we ought to leave it out, but.
Well, can we do that?
One section we leave out, it's fine, it's a question. I think if we leave it out, we can throw section four out completely. What about section five? The only reason I throw this in is the fact that in all these codes, the feeling was that involuntary servitude's gotta be handled somewhere. And the feeling was it shouldn't be handled in kidnapping because it's not that grievous. And this was a matter of breaking down again.
Is that a problem? Involuntary servitude?
Well, in the book, you know, there's still cases in the year.
Right, now, this is supposedly doing.
Then
where are we? Is there any necessity for the need for such legislation?
Well, that's the question. This certainly isn't an area where we've had people knocking at the doors demanding such legislation, nor have we had even any inquiries or requests from any source about this. But I mean, that doesn't necessarily mean it isn't needed.
Then I personally would think we should forget it because we've been quite a long way. One can hardly turn around without violating some law, which may, in some instances, be a sumptuary law. In many instances, it is. So unless, as you say, there's any missing cases that have arisen of which we're aware, where there is necessity for such a law, I don't see any purpose in taking the initiative and putting it on the law.
Well, on section five, the only thing I'd say is, this unlawful imprisonment is, you may have cases where there is a sufficient, like, it's a circumstance in which you expose a person to a risk of serious bodily injury. There could be cases where people would be exposed to a great deal of danger, and this would be the example of like locking people in like a trunk or locking them in an ice box or you know, some kind of restraint, which would not be kidnapping.
You have any of the shotgun laws that in minor instances are covered, such as this sort of conduct, these ordinances that you know, practically every code has.
I'm not sure I'd agree with your illustration about locking him in a trunk or something under your definition of abduct.
Oh yeah, well he could be right.
Then we make a policy decision that the subcommittees, we were doing it on subcommittee number one for a while, voting a section out but leaving it in for the whole commission to discuss. And then we decided that the subcommittee should make a hard blank decision and not bring these things over into full commission.
Yeah, right. Either that or we have, when we've left something out, say, where we followed another code or we followed the model penal code in a certain article and left out something that they have, we've noted that in our commentary when it goes to the commission, pointing up that, well, New York and Michigan have such and such provision, and we don't. The subcommittee left it out for the following reasons. And I think something like that. But we, you know.
All right. Well, Mr. Chairman, I have a motion.
Okay.
I move that we delete sections 4 and section 5. In their entirety.
You want to put that as one motion before 4 and 5?
Well, I'll put it. Separate motions. First, I'll move that we delete section 4.
All right. Then you heard a discussion on section 4. If not, those in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
For the opposed, same the same motion. Motion now on section 5.
Okay. I move, Mr. Chairman, that we delete section 5.
tell me why you want to delete section 5.
All right. Section 5 is essentially the same as section 4, except it's of a higher degree and would make a person guilty of unlawful imprisonment if they put another in a condition of involuntary servitude, or if they restrained another person under such circumstances as would expose that person to risk of serious bodily injury. Now, in the first instance, I just can't see where there's any compelling necessity to make it a crime for keeping a person in involuntary servitude in this day and age. I just don't think there's that pressing a need for this. Now, maybe there is, and I could be convinced if you could give me an example. Secondly, I think where a person restrained would be placed in risk of great bodily injury, I think in most of those instances, any that I can think of, would be covered under kidnapping. Now, maybe I'm wrong. But if I locked you in a room and exposed you to great bodily injury by threatening you with a gun, that would be covered under assault.
With a dangerous weapon.
Why? Right. If I locked you in a room and set the building on fire, that would be covered under arson.
Right.
If I restrained you and turned a bunch of wild dogs loose on you or something, I don't know what it would be covered by, but I can't. Give us some examples, Gene, of what you're trying to prescribe here. And maybe you can convince me. Maybe the chairman has to think of an example that this would cover. You know, this business of involuntary servitude traditionally used to have cases where somebody had a feeble-minded relative or acquaintance or somebody that didn't have complete mentality, and they would keep him on the farm or lock him up in the house or something. And every once in a while you hear something like that, but that's the
only thing. Right, how about this case that occurs sometimes where you leave some person and the parents, for some reason or other, assume the child over 16 will say to be mentally defective or what have you. And they chain them up in an attic for a considerable period of time.
That's the only case I can think of.
All right, but it's not too uncommon.
No.
But where is your penalty?
Where is our penalty now? We don't have one, do we?
Well,
this would be covered under 5, wouldn't it?
Well, if you would construe chaining him up in an attic was keeping him in a condition of involuntary servitude,
well, I could
risk
suicide in the reason there was. There was an order to keep about the man who locked his son in a child of 6 or 7 confined him in a cold, dark cellar.
Under what statute? What did they prosecute?
Well, they prosecuted
child abuse. I encountered
Which
a case
is
some.
Under child abuse too.
I encountered a case some years ago where a woman complained that her husband accused her of stepping out. She wanted to go to a dance, so he locked her in her room. Now, we're not talking about the civil remedy there. Should that be a criminal offense?
No.
No,
That's the male reaction. What's the female reaction?
Death penalty.
I just wanted to pick out this. This is model penal code county. On our involuntary servitude. One of the case they cited on that was Pierce versus the United States, where the defendant secured the release of a girl from prison by paying a fine and forcing him to prostitution in his club. And he was prosecuted in involuntary servitude.
That's a good example.
Because see, the thing that happens is involuntary servitude is usually written in as a special purpose or subsection in the kidnapping statutes. And when it's not put in kidnapping, if it's not covered in unlawful imprisonment, it's not covered within the code. For any of these cases where you can find, then they've got another one where a person was forced to work for another to pay off indebtedness. In these kind of cases, and these aren't that, these are 1944 cases, so they're not that back in the world.
Well, let's see now, what do we have in the prostitution? We have receiving the earnings of the prostitute. What's the other story?
Well, placing a female in a house of prostitution, make a distinction on that.
Well, there is, that's covered.
Yeah, you can just ask them. Yeah.
I don't know, I think that...
Covered or uncovered, it's in the law.
But this was the only case that Miles was so excited about.
Kind of hard to distinguish between those inmates and then some of the apparel the ladies were wearing on the streets that they are not wearing, isn't it?
That's right. Well, if this would get at the...
There is a statute now on involuntary servitude in Oregon Code.
I don't think so.
You're going to the 13th Amendment.
But this could... if there is that case concerning the guy that's running a few girls, this type of a statute could get at the pimp.
Yeah, but your sex statutes, John, sexual offenses, and under all the new codes, have greatly broadened the coverage there.
Have they?
Yeah. To get at these more of these kind of situations. I would think that if we're aimed at a specific kind of evil, we ought to take care of it in a specific
way. Well, I agree. Well, now, the situation involving a child, Don, we're not going to get into the child abuse statutes, but that's where you keep the child locked up or chained or whatever. That should specifically be covered under the child abuse statutes.
Yeah.
I would think. And this is a growing area of the law, and Oregon, I think, is one of the leaders in the area of child abuse. Maybe I'm wrong.
Only thing to watch, I don't know what we'll have to do, is the cutoff meeting of child abuse.
Well, we have to, this has to be coordinated, because now you have contributing up to 18 and statutory rape at 16, and.
If you take a person under your definition, Gene, and your definition of restraint and a duck, and you lock them in an attic and keep them locked up there where they're not likely to be found by anybody,
mm-hmm.
that would be kidnapping, wouldn't it, under your definition?
Suppose it was lawful in the first place. Suppose there were an inmate of the house. Suppose they were a lawful member of the house, maybe not necessarily the family of the house. Now, we're taking extreme cases here, but take a lodger. No kidnapping there. That is, the elements of kidnapping are in prison, all of them are in prison.
Well,
see,
with
a duck, secreting or holding him in a place where he's not likely to be found. Where else would a child be likely to be found other than in his own house?
I don't see anything wrong with this
See, would that be a problem?
For this section five?
Well, I don't think it's going to be a problem, because that kind of situation would be covered under child abuse and this type of thing. And if it's not a child...
Well, it's not a child.
All right, then I submit that it would be kidnapping under these definitions.
If it's a... Tom, if it's a lodger, and you lock him up, you would be restraining him by confining him either in the place where the restriction commenced, or in a place to which he's been moved without his consent and with the knowledge that the restriction is lawful, unlawful. And that would be kidnapping under our definition. Yeah.
No, that would be unlawful imprisonment. You've only got the restraint. Because he abducts, you've got to go add the element of either...
Well,
he's putting a hold in a place where he's not likely to be found. If he's lodging in a place, I would maintain that he's likely to be found there. See, the idea behind subducting is to hide the person where no one else could get at him. And if he was a lodger and you locked him in his room, other people would know he was there, and if they were looking for him, would look there. You see what I mean? Either that, or we better go back and change abducting, because we're getting too...
Well, read this now with a section.
I think we'd be getting too broad for kidnapping if we did that.
That you have a question of likely to be found. You lock me up during the day in my room, and I'm likely to be found in my office during that day. I could argue likely to be found there.
But that might be a defect in the abduct definition.
Well, I myself, I can't see the objection to retaining the body. You haven't convinced me. That should be the way.
What do you think, Don?
Well, I'm more persuaded that we need something that, with respect to the serious bodily injury aspect of it, than involuntary servitude. I think, you know, if we're talking about situations that maybe don't come up to the dignity of a kidnapping, but at the same time involve some substantial risk of injury to the person of another, that see where there might be a need for it. But I'm really not too sure that I'm convinced on the involuntary servitude aspect of it, because I think the kind of situation such as your prostitutes, that type of thing, can be better covered under other statutes. I would suggest we might compromise on it and delete the involuntary servitude aspect of it and retain the serious bodily injury portion of it.
Now, is serious bodily injury going to be defined in the general articles?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there's a note there.
Down page 3.
Yeah. Well, give me an example of unlawful imprisonment. Give me a concrete example of fact situation that would fit within the scope of Section 5.
Well, supposing that you lock someone up in a cellar full of rats. Rats were crawling all over him, gnawing at his legs. How's that for an example of the possibility of serious bodily injury?
Or just a cold, damp one in the prison gets pneumonia.
In a place where there are deadly fumes or something like that.
Or say, in a place that was unhealthful, where they might, for instance, contract pneumonia. That's not too far a stretch.
Or
under circumstances and conditions, and a serious bodily injury. Yes.
Or where you can find a small place where they could suffer.
It's like a very good friend of mine one time who was a state official here and a very prominent senator, a warm friend of mine, and he, after he'd been married a short time, his wife had a slight disagreement, and he just moved a new home out of Lewis Park College. And there wasn't anything in the basement, there was a full basement. no boxes or anything, but he went down there to check something was there, and his wife locked the door on him. The poor guy was there all afternoon, and she kept him there all that night. I won't mention his name, I think some of you may remember. We had a lot of fun with him. But, of course, he was a member of the family, married and all that. That was imprisonment.
I think the situation where he might lock, of course you probably covered under the section on sex offenses, where you could lock a person in a premises that might expose them to him.
And he couldn't reach a woman.
Serious bodily injury. Well, what do you say if we make this unlawful imprisonment and make it read a person's guilty of unlawful imprisonment if he restrains another under circumstances which expose the person restrained to risk of serious bodily injury? All right, Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
I withdraw the motion which is before the
chair. No objection. It's withdrawn.
All right, Mr. Chairman, I move that we amend Section 5 as follows. First, the title. It will read Unlawful Imprisonment, and subsection 1 will read as follows. A person is guilty of unlawful imprisonment if he restrains another person under circumstances which expose the person restrained to a risk of serious bodily injury.
Plain enough. Heard the motion, any discussion? If not, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Other opposed, same sign, motion carried.
Mr. Chairman, I move that we adopt Section 5 as amended.
You've heard the motion, any discussion? All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Other opposed, same sign, motion. Now, next.
Okay. Now we'll move on to Section 6, Custodial Interference in the Second Degree. And this will replace the current child stealing statute in American law now. And I'll just throw a few general comments on this. Child stealing is primarily directed against the person having lawful custody of the child. Now this is different than the kidnapping and unlawful imprisonment sections, which we've just discussed, where these offenses are primarily offenses against the victim. So it's a little different concept. The general rule is that a parent is not guilty of kidnapping if he takes custody of his child in the absence of a court order or decree. It is kidnapping, however, if the parent takes possession of the child from any person having lawful custody by virtue of a court decree. Now, we've put the exclusion in our kidnapping statute to cover the situation. This proposed draft has incorporated a number of policies which you may or may not disagree with, but I will throw them out to you. I said the purpose of the parent taking the child should be the determinant factor in assessing its punishment. Now, what his purpose is going to be the thing we're going to be looking at. Therefore, in the kidnapping and unlawful imprisonment sections, I put in the exclusion, which would apply only where the relative's sole purpose is the assumption of physical control over the child. If the relative's purpose in abducting a child is for any other reason than to assume control, such as for ransom, extortion, or to terrorize the mother, or for any other purpose, then the exclusion will not apply and he can be found guilty of kidnapping.
I notice you use the word neglected rather than dependent. Now, we define in our court of present time a dependent child. Did you use that in legal dependent?
Right. Mm-hmm.
Well, now wait a minute. In the third, in the next line down.
Or other dependent or kind of person. Wait a minute. I see what you were going to. No, I meant neglected or delinquent child. I meant neglected there.
But,
you know, a dependent would be anyone entrusted to another's custody by
now tell me, why did the why is 16
Well, I was going to get. Well, I was going to get to that. The age limit chosen for this draft is arbitrary. The age limit varies, as I pointed out in the commentary, from age 10 to 18, depending on the state. And I chose 16 on this because I felt that 18 was too high when in view of the fact that in admittedly a small number of cases there is the present the element that children can leave school legally at the age of 16. They can join the armed services at that age with parental permission. And so it is possible to have 17. So it is possible to have children who are independent or have them.
You're not emancipated even if you are in the armed services.
No, I don't mean emancipated in the sense of the law, but the fact is their behavior. Because now, when you define it, you have to be careful. Any person who commits the crime of custodial offense, if knowingly has no legal right to, takes and entices any child who has not yet reached the 16th birthday, and make that 18 or 19 or whatever you want. What you don't want to include are people who are just companions or friends. And the, you know, children are independently doing the things that they want to be doing, and these people would want to follow this section.
Now, what about our statutory rape statutes, where under the age of 16, and if the child is, does that mean any time up until it's reached the 17th birthday, or any time up until it's reached 16? Are you sure that's the way it is presently?
I think you're talking about our section.
No, but you say here, any child who has not yet reached his 16th birthday, and the present laws talk about anybody under the age of 16, and are those present laws interpreted as not having yet reached the 16th birthday, or not yet having reached the 17th birthday?
I don't know. I had that in our original draft. I had it worded the way you said, and I was assuming that it meant had not reached their 16th birthday. And then Justice Long said we better make it more explicit, and this is why the change in wording.
I think that for that reason, that the interpretation, for example, of 15, or in the case of interpret 15 as meaning you have not yet reached your 16th birthday, you're 15 up until such time as you reach your 16th birthday. And this was, like she said, this was language that. Came out of the last meeting, I think it was Justice Long who suggested that we make it more explicit, that we phrase it in that manner so that. Yeah, Justice Long, on page 7, suggested it would be more specific to say a child who has not reached his 16th birthday.
Well, the age limit, which you have to decide is what the limit of parental interest in custody. Which should be protected by the law is going to be in it. When we decide what age that should be, then that should be the age in this section.
Yeah.
Now the model penal code is kind of interesting. The way they did their they made it 18. Anyone who takes or tries to any child on the age of 18 in custody of parent guardian when he has no privilege to do so. But then they went on to say it's an affirmative defense that the act of believing this action was necessary to preserve the child's major welfare, which doesn't find it out. Or the child being at the time not less than 14 years old was taken away at its own instigation without enticement and without purpose to commit a criminal offense with or against the child. Because what you've got here is you've got to be careful that neighbors and friends don't get, you know, when the child is willing to go along and wants to go, if you find his age is too high, there, people are still going to be guilty of this offense.
And I think we had some discussion also.
Well, I have no objection to that 16. Jane, I just wonder why that arbitrary age was.
Right, well, that's something.
I have no objection to it.
Something to think about. Should we discuss more of a section and then maybe
you'll... You have to draw the line someplace.
On page 7 of the minutes, you mentioned Senator Mahoney at the last meeting. You noted that a child in a custody case could choose his own guardian at the age of 14, subject to the court's approval.
Right.
Well,
it was considered required. 14-year-old.
Yeah.
This was, this section would put Errol Flynn in a bad spot if he was still there.
Yeah. All right, any discussion on that? If not, why don't you make a motion to do that?
Oh, do you want to discuss some of the other aspects of the sections first?
Just a second, I'll be ready to make a motion.
Yeah, she has some older ones here too, that will be interesting.
Well, I have a semantic question to you on the fifth line. I know what you're trying to say, but I'm not so sure that it's said as artfully as it could be. Takes and ties to the child who's not yet reached his 16th birthday from the custody of his parent, party, or lawful custodian. Or, takes or entices any incompetent or committed person from the lawful custody of another person.
After the 16th birthday, getting the law in hand, so.
And I wonder if committed person doesn't, I wonder if committed person wouldn't more properly belong in the definitional section.
I had it there originally, and I thought it would be best to put it in here since this is the only section it's used in, rather than cluttering up the definition section.
If, of course, we done it both ways in subcommittee number one, but I would suggest that if we keep it in section six, we should make it subsection two.
I think your question about neglected, the use of neglected there, we're going to discuss that a little bit too.
Well,
I didn't mean to interrupt you, but no, as long as you write down that second part of the statute.
Committed person who's initiated and committed in the judicial warrant. I don't know if that's the way to use the word warrant. Any orphan, neglected, or delinquent child.
Well, under our present statutes in child care, a neglected, a dependent child is a neglected child is.
It's a dependent child.
Right. And dependent child is the term that's defined
right.
In statutes.
Right. Well, and an orphan is a dependent child, right, under our present law. And a delinquent child is a dependent child under our present law, right?
Well, I guess I was more worried about the fact that if you're using dependent, then it's almost a term of art. See, I wasn't familiar with that being. Because I wanted to make sure that all those cases were included. And I don't know if would they automatically be included if you just use one word instead of dependent. Would there be any question that the only problem?
Well, you know, we might want to insert in there, in the phrase neglected or delinquent child, assuming that we change it to say dependent child as defined in ORS such and such, or
I don't have any objection basically with six or seven as they are. I think the chairman agrees that these are good, and I do. And we're just talking about a couple of semantic differences. So can I make a motion?
Could I stop? I don't want to interrupt you, but Don and I have a few problems with both sections, which we'd like to address, and I never got on to telling you what the problems were in the section. So would you like to hear something? Would you like to make your motion? I shouldn't interrupt it.
Well, of course, those would apply to the first degree.
Right, well, I thought you were
going to
make a motion.
No, I was going to make a motion to, first motion is I move that we div-
divide section six into subsection one and subsection two, and subsection one would be the first sentence. In other words, it would be the 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. The first six complete lines of section six would be subsection one. The definition would be subsection two.
Wait a minute, see if I got it. You're referring now to this draft of section six.
Correct.
And the first section of
second motion, Mr. Chairman, is on line 5 of subsection 1. After the word or, I would insert the words takes or entices, so that this would give the subsection more clarity.
How would that read?
It would read, a person commits a crime of custodial interference in the second degree if, knowing that he has no legal right to do so, he takes or entices any child who has not yet reached his 16th birthday from the custody of its parent, guardian, or lawful custodian, or takes or entices any incompetent or committed person from the lawful custody of another person or institution.
I assume that phrase of user knowingly has no legal right to do so. The principle that a person has no legal right, but they believe it under the law they have, and that belief is no defense. Is that correct? In other words, will ignorance of the law excuse that person?
I thought we had said before that. But this is a back question again.
It's a question.
But he'll have to bring up what he believed, and it's up to the jury to believe whether or not he did or didn't.
Let's say that a father believes. He's not relying on legal advice, but he honestly believes he has the right to take a child. And the child has been placed in a court order in the custody of the mother.
Does he know the father?
Huh?
Does he know of the court order?
Well, yes, he might know the court order. That'd be the defense, but facts and attorney can run into that. Not too interesting. Well, I didn't think that the court had any right to make an order. I didn't think there was anything in those papers that were served on me. My kid went and took
it.
Yeah, well, you run into it, for example, in a contempt proceeding.
That's what I'm
yeah.
I'm not speaking now, of course, of the other contempt proceeding, but of the criminal law. But he believes that he has a legal right to do it. And yet, as a matter of law, he doesn't have a legal right to do it.
What if we change that?
He believes he
has. What if we change that to say, first commits a crime of custodial interference in the second degree if having no legal right to do so?
Knowing that he has no legal right to do so. Now he knows that this restraining order has been served for him, giving him temporary custody of the junior, so on and so forth, the money. In good faith, he may not know the legal effect of that.
Well, this makes the prosecutor prove that he knew that he had no legal right to do so, the way it is here. It's pretty damn hard to prove.
The other way that you were making, the fair either.
This, I suppose, is an mens rea offense, isn't it? Criminal intent is necessary. And he could argue, I didn't intend to break the law because I didn't know.
Well, see, my feeling with this was that he knew.
In other words, is that language necessary, knowing that he has no legal right to do so?
It reminds me of the situation with the suspended operator in this case, where the state has to prove that not only that the defendant's license was suspended, but that the defendant knew that his license was suspended. And the way you prove that is by getting a certified copy of the mailing certificate and the return receipt signed by the suspended driver. But in this situation, how does the state carry its burden and prove that the defendant knew that he had no legal right to do it? You introduce the copy of the decree, but the defendant says, I didn't pay attention to those papers. I didn't read them.
Well, I wouldn't think that would be a defense, because if he'd seen the papers and you bring it out and say, were you aware that custody was going to be made? Yeah, but I didn't think it had any effect. Well, that's like in any other type of situation where you get a ticket and you say, well, I didn't think it meant anything. I tore it up. Well, that doesn't get you off on the fact that you were aware that you had it. See, what I guess I was, my feeling was that it would, if you knew at the time you took the child that custody decree had been rendered against you, then you would be guilty under this. And if you wanted to contest that, then you have to go through the courts and contest the legality of that custody decree, but you couldn't. But you would still be guilty under this. But then you wouldn't be guilty under this if you didn't know that the decree had ever been rendered. You see what I mean?
Exactly what you mean.
Now, maybe I didn't say it right. It isn't clear from the statute, but I feel there's got to be some element, there has to be a culpability element in here. Because if you just make it the taking alone, then you don't allow for the two situations.
What about a situation where at the end, the state introduces a decree, doesn't have any evidence whatsoever that the defendant received a copy of the decree, it was a default divorce. No evidence that the defendant had a copy of the decree. He introduced the decree, and at the end of the state's case, the defendant moves for judgment of acquittal based on the fact that the state had not proved that the defendant knew that he didn't have the right. There's no evidence in there that he ever received or read the decree. Judgment granted, motion for judgment of acquittal.
Well, I can't seem to locate it in the minutes, but it seems to me we talked about that in the last meeting, and we talked about knowing or having, using the language, or having reason to know.
And that was what you had done in the theft test. Mm-hmm.
To get away, like on our theft by receiving, John, the test we used there is knowing or having reason to know that the property is the subject of theft.
And you decided that that was almost an academic question, because the jury could still draw the same inference. Knowing is going to be defined in the code with knowledge will be an element of culpability. It will be defined, we think, similar to the model penal code. Court method is defining it now.
In fact, those will be over tomorrow. But today, as a matter of fact, it's supposed to have his draft order today.
So,
did they want to take it back?
But this is the way knowingly will be defined. I don't know if this would help you. A person acts knowingly with respect to a material element of an offense when, if the element involves the nature of his conduct or the intended circumstances, he is aware that his conduct is of that nature or that such circumstances exist. And if the element involves the result of his conduct, he is aware that it is practically certain that his conduct will cause it.
Well, fine. No. Well, the chairman raises a good question, and I'm glad he did, because got me thinking. And
It's one way or the other. If you leave it the way it is, I think it places an unreasonable burden on the prosecution. Because after all, the defendant can't be called as an adverse witness. On the other hand, if we take it out, it places more of a burden on the defendant. However, I think we're talking about a misdemeanor anyway, aren't we? And we have a certain public policy to abide. And why don't we just say, if having no legal right to do so?
Well, it seems to me you're inviting an offense. It's already there. You're emphasizing the offense that it'll be available to any event, at least in matters of this kind involving custody of a child.
You just take it out altogether, and you'd say, person commits a crime of custodial interference in the second degree if he takes or entices any child who is not.
And if he believes that he has a right to do it, why, as a practical matter, what I'm trying to say, why, certainly any sensible court would take that into consideration, I would think, or a jury, without inviting it. Certainly, as a lawyer, that would be the first thing that occurred to me. Or to a sensible prosecutor.
Our present statute 163640 doesn't have any knowledge element except insofar as it goes to the criminal intent of the statute, that is maliciously, forcibly, or fraudulently. Of course, those would impliedly contain a mens rea element, but there isn't anything about knowing that he has no legal.
Well, it's like, let's put it in a comparative defense, we'll say, on the NSF check. Under certain circumstances, a government menace check is prima facie evidence of intent to defraud. And if a person said, well, I honestly believe I had a balance in there, and they believe him, that's a defense. But the law doesn't say believing that he had, knowing it knowingly, drew it knowing that he had no account or had no balance.
Why couldn't we take out the knowledge element that you have in there and then add to it the intent to detain aspect that's in our present law?
You mean it'd be an intent to detain?
Then you'd have to show that there was an unlawful intent.
I see.
Which I think would be fair, more fair from the standpoint of the defendant, but that wouldn't place any more of a burden on the state than it has right now.
What would you say, if he unlawfully takes or entices?
He unlawfully takes and all that, then would be intent.
Well, I don't know if we want to use unlawfully, because I don't know whether we're going to have unlawfully defined in the place.
Well, I'd be inclined to believe knowing that he has no legal right to do so. So we just read, a person commits a crime of custodial interference in the second degree if he takes or entices any child who has not yet reached the 16th birthday.
Well, is your motion merely to delete knowing he had no lawful right to do so? Do you stop there?
Right.
All those in favor of the motion, signify by saying aye. Opposed, no. That's it. Got anything to add to it?
Well, I just thought maybe better repeat that for Mildred when she gets back, so she can be sure to have her notes.
Okay, then just for the sake of the commentary, is it our purpose that if the parent has never heard of the custody decree, doesn't know anything about it, and doesn't, he still will be guilty under the section, but when he comes to trial, then he can.
Mildred,
presented as a defense, that's how we will be.
Oh, we pardon.
You want to take just a short break while you're gone, or do you want to take a little break?
Yeah.
Oh, he's on the phone. I know, he's trying to like.
Well, now, we just
shot something great.
Shot an amendment through with you. Opposite, Oasis. Line two, following the word if, delete the words, knowing that he has no legal right to do so. Now.
Yeah. For the sake of time, just tell me what your thinking is on that.
My thinking is, if he commits the crime of custodial interference, if he takes or entices away any child,
just by doing it.
Now, he wants to, if he's charged with that, he has the defense coming in and saying, okay, I did it, but I'm his father. The state says, well, you're his father, but there was a decree that was entered. And he says, I didn't know anything about it. And the state has to instruct on criminal intent. And he can argue, yeah, I did it. I didn't know anything about this decree. Therefore, I didn't have any criminal intent.
Is there any point, now I'm not that familiar with the instructions, but would there ever be the inference that just because it's been handed down, that he should have had reason to know of it? Well, would he know the sense? This is what I'm kind of worried about, is how does the judge instruct him? I'm not that familiar with Oregon law.
I used to argue that the jury is the court will instruct you that from the commission of an unlawful act, you may infer that it was committed with unlawful intent. But I don't know whether the Supreme Court has struck that.
Yeah, yet. They have.
They have,
yeah.
They held that in the Constitution.
So all those guys down there could I got out of that office.
And you know why I remember that? Because I had the case, one of the first criminal cases I ever tried.
I just have to find out one thing. Do you want to leave the first part of Section 6 the way it is now that you've deleted any mens rea or any culpability requirement? Do you want to leave it that way, or do you want some type of culpability inserted in there? Some mens rea inserted. Now, what it would be.
Let's approve Section 6, and then empower you to draft an alternative, which we'll tentatively approve and have it in the draft of this commission. Without spending any more time on the alternative. How about that?
You're talking about an alternative that would embody a culpability on
it? Right, right.
Something other than knowledge, or?
Well, I don't know. I like it okay the way it is, but it is strict liability. And I'm afraid we're going to get hung up for half hour or an hour on reaching a precise formula.
Mm-hmm. Well, what would you think of stating, if knowing or having reason to know, that he has no legal right to do so? But really, as a practical matter, may not make all that difference, but from the standpoint of a prosecutor, it might give a little more to argue with the jury about. If you had language like that in the stand.
No one should have known.
Because we use similar language in our theft by receiving. In other words, that way, then you could, if you could show that there was a court order, and that it was a valid order, at least there you could show constructive notice, which would get you at least to a jury on the question of knowledge. I think you'd probably get to a jury even with the language of knowing, because any evidence tending to show knowledge is going to be enough to get to a jury.
Do you think that by taking it out, it makes it too hard on the guy?
Then it's an inter-array thing anyway, it doesn't state anyway after proof of intent.
Well, all you'd have to do now would be to show that such and such a person had left for custody of his child. So-and-so enticed or took away. And there's your prima facie criminal case now.
That's good.
I move we adopt section 6 as amended.
Adopt culpability.
I know, I feel the same way. How can it grab you?
I think it's something beyond constitutional.
I think it's like that.
Of course, you have so many other statutes that cover this. For instance, contributing to the delinquency of a minor in certain circumstances, enticing a female under a minority covers it. Tending to cause a child to become delinquent.
Well, yeah, but that doesn't cover the situation where that is worst case and the custody hasn't been awarded yet. Or the custody has been awarded and the father takes a child away. And that isn't going to be covered anyplace else, I don't think.
You don't think your objection would be solved if we just inserted unlawfully after P. P unlawfully takes, et cetera, et cetera.
Well, the only thing is, John, I think unlawfully is just the kind of language that we're trying to eliminate from our code because unlawfully can have so many different meanings.
Well, if we the deleted language in, you agree that the burden is on the state to show that he knew. And how do you show it?
Well, to notify the parents, putting in the mail, is not going to be able to receive it. Now, how does that work? That shouldn't
be. I have a divorce case right now where I served the and by publication, nobody knows where she is. I have no way of being agreed to her. That'd be a default decree. Of course, she comes back to town and takes those kids out, not knowing that she doesn't have a legal right to do so, or maybe justifiably contended that it's hard for the prosecutor to do that.
Well, the Model Penal Code says when he has no privilege to do so.
Well, that circumscribes him. He has no privilege. Why, the fact that he thought he has a privilege is no defense.
Yeah, but they say it's just another way of stating culpability.
What if you say you have no legal right to do so?
Another way of saying it, he does what he has no right to do.
But that still doesn't mean he would have no legal right, that doesn't mean he knows he has no legal right. He still wouldn't have to be aware of it.
Well, let's get this settled for Ken.
If you think your objection would be met by reinstating the deleted language,
I'll be amenable to doing that. However, I want you to tell me whether or not, if that deleted language is in there, if it's not incumbent upon the prosecutor to show that the defendant knew.
Let me throw this in for what it's worth. Suppose you just put it the other way. Suppose you say with evil intent, was that incumbent?
No.
What about
if he knows or reasonably could,
what does that mean?
Knows or reasonably could know.
Like
something like that.
If what?
He actually knows or reasonably should have known that he had no right to it.
Well, he knew or should have known. Yeah.
If
that would open it up a little bit.
A person commits a crime of custodial interference in a second degree. If he knows or reasonably should have known that he has no legal right to do so.
Well, John, in answer to your earlier question of whether or not it would be incumbent upon the state to show that he actually knew, it would be incumbent upon the state to produce evidence tending to show that he knew, just like it to prove any other kind of criminal intent or criminal knowledge. You may not actually be able to know exactly what he knew, but you would have circumstantial evidence tending to show knowledge. It'd just be a question of whether you sustain the burden of proof or not. You'd have to show that. I think that if you had evidence tending to show knowledge, that would entitle you to an instruction to the jury that they could infer actual knowledge. If you could show, for example, that a decree had been entered, a court order of some kind, that this had been done X number of months before the child was taken away, and a copy was mailed to him, or any number of things, or that somebody had told him at one time there had been a court order. I think the state would have to have some evidence, but well, you'd have, you know, any more than any other kind of case you could ever show actual knowledge.
I think your suggestion of if he knows or reasonably should have known, if knowing or having reason to know. Alright. Okay, I'll make a motion. That we amend section one, subsection one, as amended, by the following language commencing on line two. If knowing or having reason to know that he has no legal right to do so. Is that good?
Yeah, got that one. All right, all those in favor, signify the same name.
Aye.
Those opposed, same the same. Motion carried.
I move that we adopt section six as amended.
All those in favor, signify by saying aye. Those opposed, same the same. Motion carried.
I move that we adopt section seven.
All those in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Carried.
I move we adjourn.
You can't adopt section seven. You can do it, okay. Take a look at the alternate draft for section 7. Everyone's got one. I'll just tell you what Dan and I discussed this yesterday. Dan brought up the objection that custodial interference in the first degree, section 7, as it is, first of all, I'd like to say the draft originally had the wording person taken in custody of lawful custody to a risk of person's safety will be endangered or the health will be materially impaired. At the last meeting, Justice Sloan thought that this was not a good standard. We discussed this and the risk of bodily injury was inserted. But I was hoping we could bring that back for discussion to go back to the original standard that we had. Now, in light of that, look at Section 7, the alternate we drafted. Section 6 that's contemplated is going to be a misdemeanor. Now, extradition is not available for misdemeanor offenses, so down draws the fact of what happens when a parent takes a child from lawful custody of another parent and leaves the state. There would be no way other than a civil remedy that we could get the child back. And this was drafted, this alternate was drafted with the idea of aggravating the offense to a felony if the child was removed from the state so that we could obtain jurisdiction. We would obtain extradition to get the child and the parent back. And this was what we were going to discuss under Section 7 today, whether or not there was a need for such a provision.
You know, it may or may not be a problem, but I just felt that at least it merited some.
Let me ask a question. You know, but also, suppose if you secrete the individual, the child, back in the state, doesn't remove it, but secretes it.
Well, then there's no problem because you can still. I mean, that is the problem we're trying to work out. We're trying to work out when he crossed the state line because he would still be guilty of a custodial interference, even if, you know, under Section 6. And if you found him, you could still prosecute him for the misdemeanor and get the child.
But once he leaves Oregon, for example, under our Section 6, what are you going to do?
One of them ran off, the kids back to Iowa. One day after.
The thing is, if you don't put anything in there, what you really do is you leave a lot of custody to be seized and run.
And like I told Gene, we were talking about this yesterday, and I said, well, and I think this is true, that most district attorneys would welcome the chance to stay out of custody battles. They don't want to get involved in this. And for the most part, we should leave these up to the divorce courts and civil remedies. But once in a while, and I've had cases like this, you will get a situation involving a parent where there's been a court order and the child is stolen from the parent, having lawful custody, and is taken out of the state. Now, under our present law, you can go either under kidnapping or you can go under the taking away a child with intent to detain. And that's normally where you go under our present statute. But if we replace our present child stealing statute, which is an extraditable offense, with Section 6, then we would not have an offense if we could proceed against a person if he were a parent and left the state with the child. And so we talked about some other aggravating factors, and that resulted in this Section 7 alternate that Gene drafted.
So, our reasons are in the commentary that we have talked about.
Well, your thinking is, Don, then, that the adoption of 7 will cover the situation. It would permit extradition.
That's assuming that that would be graded as a felony. That would be our intent, that this would be...
I don't like it. What's wrong with it?
It's fine. I'll move that we...
All right, you heard the motion.
That we withdraw withdraw the motion by which we previously passed Section 7 and... my first motion is that we withdraw the motion by which we previously passed Section 7.
But you do what? First motion, what?
We previously passed Section 7. We've got to nullify that action by withdrawing that.
Well, why don't you put it this way? Put it in one motion. That Section 7 should be substituted for the previous one.
All right.
It takes care of it. All right. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. That's it. Anything else? All right. Motion. Senator Brennan move the meeting adjourned until when?
Well, this will...
Call the director. And his assistants. All right, all those papers, if I say anything, that's it. Take it out.
And I want to thank Senator Burns for being kind enough to attend today.
You see that he received a time and a half.
Okay.